This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Beach Read by Emily Henry. Read for you by Julia Whalen. For Joey, you are so perfectly my favorite person. Chapter 1. The House. I have a fatal flaw. I like to think we all do, or at least that makes it easier for me when I'm writing, building my heroines and heroes up around this one self-sabotaging trait, hinging everything that happens to them on a specific characteristic, the thing they learned to do to protect themselves and can't let go of, even when it stops serving them. Maybe, for example, you didn't have much control over your life as a kid. So, to avoid disappointment, you learned never to ask yourself what you truly wanted. And it worked for a long time. Only now, upon realizing you didn't get what you didn't know you wanted, you're barreling down the highway in a midlife crisis mobile with a suitcase full of cash and a man named Stan in your trunk. Maybe your fatal flaw is that you don't use turn signals. Or maybe, like me, you're a hopeless romantic. You just can't stop telling yourself the story, the one about your own life, complete with melodramatic soundtrack and golden light lancing through car windows. It started when I was 12. My parents sat me down to tell me the news. Mom had gotten her first diagnosis, suspicious cells in her left breast, and she told me not to worry so many times I suspected I'd be grounded if she caught me at it. My mom was a doer, a laugher, an optimist, not a worrier. But I could tell she was terrified. And so I was too, frozen on the couch, unsure how to say anything without making things worse. But then my bookish homebody of a father did something unexpected. He stood and grabbed our hands, one of Mom's, one of mine, and said, "You know what we need to get these bad feelings out? We need to dance." Our suburb had no clubs, just a mediocre steakhouse with a Friday night cover band. But Mom lit up like he'd just suggested taking a private jet to the Copacabana. She wore her buttery yellow dress and some hammered metal earrings that twinkled when she moved. Dad ordered 20-year-old scotch for them and a Shirley Temple for me, and the three of us twirled and bobbed until we were dizzy, laughing, tripping all over. We laughed until we could barely stand, and my famously reserved father sang along to Brown-Eyed Girl like the whole room wasn't watching us. And then, exhausted, we piled into the car and drove home through the quiet, Mom and Dad holding tight to each other's hands between the seats, and I tipped my head against the car window and, watching the streetlights flicker across the glass, thought, "It's going to be okay. We will always be okay." And that was the moment I realized, when the world felt dark and scary, love could whisk you off to go dancing, laughter could take some of the pain away, beauty could punch holes in your fear. I decided then that my life would be full of all three, not just for my own benefit, but for Mom's and for everyone else around me. There would be purpose, there would be beauty. There would be candlelight and Fleetwood Mac playing softly in the background. The point is, I started telling myself a beautiful story about my life, about fate and the way things work out, and by 28 years old, my story was perfect. Perfect, cancer-free parents who called several times a week, tipsy on wine or each other's company. Perfect, spontaneous, multilingual, 6'3" boyfriend who worked in the ER and knew how to make coq au vin. Perfect shabby chic apartment in Queens. Perfect job writing romantic novels inspired by perfect parents and perfect boyfriend for Sandy Low Books. Perfect life. But it was just a story. And when one gaping plot hole appeared, the whole thing unraveled. That's how stories work. Now, at 29, I was miserable, broke, semi-homeless, very single, and pulling up to a gorgeous lake house whose very existence nauseated me. Grandly romanticizing my life had stopped serving me, but my fatal flaw was still riding shotgun in my dinged-up Kia Soul, narrating things as they happened. January Andrews stared out the car window at the angry lake beating up on the dusky shore. She tried to convince herself that coming here hadn't been a mistake. It was definitely a mistake, but I had no better option. You didn't turn down free lodging when you were broke. I parked on the street and stared up at the oversized cottage's facade, its gleaming windows and fairy tale of a porch, the shaggy beach grass dancing in the warm breeze. I checked the address in my GPS against the handwritten one hanging from the house key. This was it, all right. For a minute, I stalled, like maybe a world-ending asteroid would take me out before I was forced to go inside. Then I took a deep breath and got out, wrestling my overstuffed suitcase from the back seat, along with the cardboard box full of gin handles. I pushed a fistful of dark hair out of my eyes to study the cornflower blue shingles and snow-white trim. Just pretend you're at an Airbnb. Immediately, an imaginary Airbnb listing ran through my head. 3-bedroom, 3-bath, lakeside cottage brimming with charm, and proof your father was an asshole and your life has been a lie. I started up the steps cut into the grassy hillside, blood rushing through my ears like fire hoses and legs wobbling, anticipating the moment the hell mouth would open and the world would drop out from under me. That already happened, last year, and it didn't kill you, so neither will this. On the porch, every sensation in my body heightened. The tingling in my face, the twist in my stomach, the sweat prickling along my neck. I balanced the box of gin against my hip and slipped the key into the lock, a part of me hoping it would jam, that all this would turn out to be an elaborate practical joke Dad had set up for us before he died. Or, better yet, he wasn't actually dead. He'd jump out from behind the bushes and scream, "Gotcha! You didn't really think I had a secret second life, did you? You couldn't possibly think I had a second house with some woman other than your mother." The key turned effortlessly. The door swung inward. The house was silent. An ache went through me, the same one I'd felt at least once a day since I got Mom's call about the stroke and heard her sob those words, "He's gone, Janie." No Dad. Not here. Not anywhere. And then the second pain, the knife twisting. The father you knew never existed anyway. I'd never really had him, just like I'd never really had my ex, Jacques, or his coq au vin. It was just a story I'd been telling myself. From now on, it was the ugly truth or nothing. I steeled myself and stepped inside. My first thought was that the ugly truth wasn't super ugly. My dad's love nest had an open floor plan, a living room that spilled into a funky blue-tiled kitchen and homey breakfast nook, the wall of windows just beyond overlooking a dark-stained deck. If Mom had owned this place, everything would have been a mix of creamy, calming neutrals. The bohemian room I'd stepped into would have been more at home in Jacques and my old place than my parents. I felt a little queasy imagining Dad here, among these things Mom never would have picked out. The folksy, hand-painted breakfast table, the dark wooden bookshelves, the sunken couch covered in mismatched pillows. There was no sign of the version of him that I'd known. My phone rang in my pocket, and I set the box on the granite countertop to answer the call. "Hello?" It came out weak and raspy. "How is it?" the voice on the other end said immediately. "Is there a sex dungeon?" "Shoddy?" I guessed. I tucked the phone between my ear and shoulder as I unscrewed the cap from one of my gin bottles, taking a swig to fortify myself. "It honestly worries me that I'm the only person who might call you to ask that," Shoddy answered. "You're the only person who even knows about the Love Shack," I pointed out. "I am not the only one who knows about it," Shoddy argued. Technically true. While I'd found out about my father's secret lake house at his funeral last year, Mom had been aware much longer. "Fine," I said. "You're the only person I told about it. Anyway, give me a second, I just got here."
"Literally?"
Shadi was breathing hard, which meant she was walking to a shift at the restaurant. Since we kept such different hours, most of our calls happened when she was on her way into work. "Metaphorically," I said. "Literally, I've been here for 10 minutes, but I only just feel that I have arrived."
"So wise," Shadi said. "So deep."
"Shh," I said. "I'm taking it all in."
"Check for the sex dungeon,"
Shadi hurried to say, as if I were hanging up on her. I was not. I was simply holding the phone to my ear, holding my breath, holding my racing heart in my chest as I scanned my father's second life. And there, just when I could convince myself Dad couldn't possibly have spent time here, I spotted something framed on the wall, a clipping of a New York Times bestsellers list from 3 years ago, the same one he'd positioned over the fireplace at home. There I was, at number 15, the bottom slot. And there, three slots above me, in a sick twist of fate, was my college rival, Gus. Though now he went by Augustus because serious man, and his highbrow debut novel, The Revelatories. It had stayed on the list for 5 weeks. Not that I was counting. I was absolutely counting.
"Well," Shadi prompted, "what do you think?"
I turned, and my eyes caught on the mandala tapestry hanging over the couch. I'm led to wonder if Dad smoked weed. I spun toward the windows at the side of the house, which aligned almost perfectly with the neighbors, a design flaw Mom would never have overlooked when house shopping. But this wasn't her house, and I could clearly see the floor-to-ceiling bookshelves that lined the neighbor's study.
"Oh, God, maybe it's a grow house, not a love shack,"
Shadi sounded delighted.
"You should have read the letter, January. It's all been a misunderstanding. Your dad's leaving you the family business. That woman was his business partner, not his mistress."
How bad was it that I wished she were right? Either way, I'd fully intended to read the letter. I'd just been waiting for the right time, hoping the worst of my anger would settle and those last words from Dad would be comforting. Instead, a full year had passed, and the dread I felt at the thought of opening the envelope grew every day. It was so unfair that he should get the last word and I'd have no way to reply, to scream or cry or demand more answers. Once I'd opened it, there'd be no going back. That would be it, the final goodbye. So, until further notice, the letter was living a happy, if solitary, life in the bottom of the gin box I'd brought with me from Queens. "It's not a grow house," I told Shadi, and slid open the back door to step onto the deck. "Unless the weed's in the basement."
"No way," Shadi argued. "That's where the sex dungeon is."
"Let's stop talking about my depressing life," I said. "What's new with you?"
"You mean the haunted hat," Shadi said.
If only she had fewer than four roommates in her shoebox apartment in Chicago, then maybe I'd be staying with her now. Not that I was capable of getting anything done when I was with Shadi, and my financial situation was too dire not to get something done. I had to finish my next book in this rent-free hell. Then maybe I could afford my own Jacques-free place.
"If the haunted hat is what you want to talk about," I said, "then yes, spill."
"Still hasn't spoken to me," Shadi sighed wistfully.
"But I can, like, sense him looking at me when we're both in the kitchen, because we have a connection."
"Are you at all worried that your connection isn't with the guy who's wearing the antique pork pie hat, but perhaps with the ghost of the hat's original owner? What will you do if you realize you've fallen in love with a ghost?"
Shadi thought for a minute. "I guess I'd have to update my Tinder bio."
A breeze rippled off the water at the bottom of the hill, ruffling my brown waves across my shoulders, and the setting sun shot golden spears of light over everything, so bright and hot I had to squint to see the wash of oranges and reds it cast across the beach. If this were just some house I'd rented, It would be the perfect place to write the adorable love story I'd been promising Sandy Low Books for months. Shoddy, I realized, had been talking. More about the haunted hat. His name was Ricky, but we never called him that. We always spoke of Shoddy's love life in code. There was the older man who ran the amazing seafood restaurant, the Fish Lord, and then there was some guy we'd called Mark because he looked like some other famous Mark, and now there was this new coworker, a bartender who wore a hat every day that Shoddy loathed and yet could not resist. I snapped back into the conversation as Shoddy was saying, 4th of July weekend? Can I visit then? That's more than a month away. I wanted to argue that I wouldn't even be here by then, but I knew it wasn't true. It would take me at least all summer to write a book, empty the house, and sell both, so I could, hopefully, be catapulted back into relative comfort. Not in New York, but somewhere less expensive. I imagined Duluth was affordable. Mom would never visit me there. But we hadn't done much visiting this past year anyway, apart from my 3-day trip home for Christmas. She'd dragged me to 4 yoga classes, 3 crowded juice bars, and a Nutcracker performance starring some kid I didn't know, like if we were alone for even a second, the topic of Dad would arise, and we'd burst into flames. All my life, my friends had been jealous of my relationship with her. How often and freely, or so I thought, we talked. How much fun we had together. Now our relationship was the world's least competitive game of phone tag. I'd gone from having 2 loving parents and a live-in boyfriend to basically just having Shoddy, my much too long-distance best friend. The one blessing of moving from New York to North Bear Shores, Michigan, was that I was closer to her place in Chicago. 4th of July's too far off, I complained. You're only 3 hours away. Yeah, and I don't know how to drive. Then you should probably give that license back, I said. Believe me, I'm waiting for it to expire. I'm going to feel so free. I hate when people think I'm able to drive just because legally I am. Shoddy was a terrible driver. She screamed whenever she turned left. Besides, you know how scheduling off is in the industry. I'm lucky my boss said I could have 4th of July. For all I know, he's expecting a blowjob now. No way. Blowjobs are for major holidays. What you've got on your hands is a good old-fashioned foot job quid pro quo. I took another sip of gin, then turned from the end of the deck and nearly yelped. On the deck 10 feet to the right of mine, the back of a head of curly brown hair peeked over a lawn chair. I silently prayed the man was asleep. That I wouldn't have to spend an entire summer next door to someone who'd heard me shout, good old-fashioned foot job. As if he'd read my mind, he sat forward and grabbed the bottle of beer from his patio table, took a swig, and sat back. So true. I won't even have to take my Crocs off, Shoddy was saying. Anyway, I just got to work, but let me know if it's drugs or leather in the basement. I turned my back to the neighbor's deck. I'm not going to check until you visit. Rude, Shoddy said. Leverage, I said. Love you. Love you more, she insisted, and hung up. I turned to face the curly head, half waiting for him to acknowledge me, half debating whether I was obligated to introduce myself. I hadn't known any of my neighbors in New York well, but this was Michigan, and from Dad's stories about growing up in North Bear Shores, I fully expected to have to lend this man sugar at some point. Note, must buy sugar. I cleared my throat and pasted on my attempt at a neighborly smile. The man sat forward for another swig of beer, and I called across the gap, "Sorry for disturbing you." He waved one hand vaguely, then turned the page of whatever book was in his lap.
"What's disturbing about foot jobs as a form of currency?"
he drawled in a husky, bored voice. I grimaced as I searched for a reply, any reply. Old January would have known what to say, but my mind was as blank as it was every time I opened Microsoft Word. Okay, so maybe I'd become a bit of a hermit this past year. Maybe I wasn't entirely sure what I'd spent the last year doing, since it wasn't visiting Mom, and it wasn't writing, and it wasn't charming the socks off my neighbors. Anyway, I called. I'm living here now. As if he'd read my thoughts, he gave a disinterested wave and grumbled,
"Let me know if you need any sugar."
But he managed to make it sound more like, "Never speak to me again unless you notice my house is on fire, and even then, listen for sirens first." So much for Midwestern hospitality. At least in New York, our neighbors had brought us cookies when we moved in. They'd been gluten-free and laced with LSD, but it was the thought that counted.
"Or if you need directions to the nearest sexual fetish depot," the grump added.
Heat flared through my cheeks, a flush of embarrassment and anger. The words were out before I could reconsider.
"I'll just wait for your car to pull out and follow."
He laughed, a surprised, rough sound, but still didn't deign to face me.
"Lovely to meet you,"
I added sharply, and turned to hurry back through the sliding glass doors to the safety of the house, where I would quite possibly have to hide all summer.
"Liar,"
I heard him grumble before I snapped the door shut. Chapter 2. The Funeral. I wasn't ready to look through the rest of the house, so I settled down at the table to write. As usual, the blank document stared accusingly at me, refusing to fill itself with words or characters, no matter how long I stared back. Here's the thing about writing happily ever afters. It helps if you believe in them. Here's the thing about me. I did, until the day of my father's funeral. My parents, my family, had been through so much already, and somehow we always came through it stronger, with more love and laughter than before. There was the brief separation when I was a kid, and Mom started feeling like she'd lost her identity, started staring out windows like she might see herself out there living life and figure out what she needed to do next. There was the kitchen dancing, hand-holding and forehead kissing that followed when Dad moved back in. There was Mom's first cancer diagnosis and the wildly expensive celebratory dinner when she kicked its ass, eating like we were millionaires, laughing until their overpriced wine and my Italian soda sprayed from our respective noses, like we could afford to waste it, like the medical debt didn't exist. And then the second bout of cancer, and the new lease on life after the mastectomy, the pottery classes, ballroom dancing classes, yoga classes, Moroccan cooking classes that my parents filled their schedules with, like they were determined to pack as much life into as little time as possible. Long weekend trips to see me and Jacques in New York, rides on the subway, during which Mom begged me to stop regaling her with stories of our pothead neighbors Sharon and Karen, not related, regularly slid informational flat earth pamphlets under our door because she was afraid she was going to pee herself, all while Dad debunked the flat earth theory under his breath for Jacques. Trial, happy ending. Tribulation, happy ending. Chemo, happy ending. And then, right in the middle of the happiest ending yet, he was just gone. I was just standing there, in the foyer of his and Mom's Episcopalian church, in a sea of black-clad people whispering useless words, feeling like I'd sleepwalked there, barely able to recall the flight, the ride to the airport, packing, remembering, for the millionth time in the last 3 days, that he was gone. Mom had slipped into the bathroom, and I was alone when I saw her, the only woman I didn't recognize. Dressed in a gray dress and leather sandals, a crocheted shawl tied around her shoulders, and her white hair wind-tossed. She was staring right at me. After a beat, she swept toward me, and for some reason, my stomach bottomed out, as if my body knew first that things were about to change. This stranger's presence at Dad's funeral was going to wrench my life off track as much as his death had. She smiled hesitantly as she stopped in front of me. She smelled like vanilla and citrus. "Hello, January." Her voice was breathy, and her fingers twirled anxiously through the fringe on her shawl. "I've heard so much about you. Behind her, the bathroom door swung open and Mom walked out. She stopped short, frozen with an unfamiliar expression. Recognition? Horror? She didn't want the two of us to talk. What did that mean?
I'm an old friend of your father's, the woman said. He meant a lot to me. I've known him all my life, just about. For quite some time, we were thick as thieves, and he never shut up about you.
Her laugh tried for easy, missed it by a light year.
I'm sorry, she said, hoarse. I promised I wouldn't cry, but...
I felt like I'd been shoved off a building, like the dropping would never end. Old friend, that was what she said, not lover or mistress. But I knew, from the way she was crying, some funhouse mirror version of Mom's tears during the funeral. I recognized the look on her face as the same one I'd seen on mine this morning while I tapped concealer under my eyes. Dad's death had irreparably broken her. She fished something out of her pocket, an envelope with my name scrawled across it, a key resting atop it. A tab hung from the key with an address scribbled in the same unmistakable handwriting as the chicken scratch on the envelope. Dad's.
He wanted you to have this, she said. It's yours.
She pushed it into my palm, holding on for a second.
It's a beautiful house right on Lake Michigan, she blurted. You'll love it. He always said that you would. And the letter is for your birthday. You can open it then, or... whenever.
My birthday. My birthday wasn't for another 7 months. My dad would not be there for my birthday. My dad was gone. Behind the woman, Mom unfroze, moving toward us with a murderous expression.
Sonia,
she hissed. And then I knew the rest. That while I'd been in the dark, Mom had not. I closed the Word document. Like clicking that little X in the corner would shut out the memories, too. Looking for a distraction, I scrolled through my inbox to the latest email from my agent, Anya. It had arrived 2 days ago, before I left New York, and I'd found increasingly ridiculous reasons for putting off opening it. Packing, moving things into storage, driving, trying to drink as much water as I could while peeing. Writing, heavy on the scare quotes. Drunk. Hungry, breathing. Anya had a reputation for being tough, a bulldog on the publisher's end of things, but on the writer's end, she was something like Miss Honey, the sweet teacher from Matilda, mashed together with a sexy witch. You always desperately wanted to please her, both because you had the sense that no one had loved and admired you so purely before, and because you suspected she could sick a herd of pythons on you if she so chose. I drained my third gin and tonic of the night, opened the email, and read,
"Hello, you beautiful and miraculous jellyfish, angelic artist, money maker mine. I know things have been so crazy on your end, but Sandy's writing again. Really wants to know how the manuscript's coming, / whether it will still be ready by the end of the summer. As ever, I'm more than happy to hop on the phone, or instant message, or a Pegasus is back as need be, to help you brainstorm, / hash out plot details, / whatever it takes to help bring more of your beautiful words and unparalleled swoon into the world. 5 books in 5 years was a tall order for anyone, even someone with your spectacular talent, but I do believe we've reached a breaking point with SLB, and it's time to grin and birth it. If at all possible. XOX, Anya.
Grin and birth it. I suspected it'd be easier to deliver a fully formed human baby out of my uterus at the end of this summer than to write and sell a new book. I decided that if I went to sleep now, I could pop out of bed early and crank out a few thousand words. I hesitated outside the downstairs bedroom. There was no way to be sure which beds Dad and that woman had partaken of. I was in a funhouse of geriatric adultery.
It might have been funny if I hadn't lost the ability to find anything funny in the last year spent penning rom-coms that ended with a bus driver falling asleep and the whole cast going off a cliff. "It's super interesting," I always imagined Anya saying if I were to actually send in one of these drafts. "I mean, I would read your grocery list and laugh-cry doing it, but it's not a Sandy Lowe book. For now, more swoon and less doom, baby cakes." I was going to need help sleeping here. I poured myself another G&T and closed my computer. The house had gotten hot and stuffy, so I stripped to my underwear, then circled the first floor, opening windows, before draining my glass and flopping onto the couch. It was even more comfortable than it looked. Damn that woman with her beautifully eclectic tastes. It was also, I decided, too low to the ground for a man with a bad back to be climbing on and off of, which meant it was probably not used for sex. Though Dad hadn't always had a bad back. When I was a kid, he'd take me out on the boat most weekends that he was home, and from what I'd seen, boating was 90% bending over to tie and untie knots and 10% staring into the sun, your arms thrown wide to let the wind race through your swishy jacket, and the ache rose with a vengeance in my chest. Those early mornings on the man-made lake 30 minutes from our house had always been just for the two of us, usually the morning after he got back from a trip. Sometimes I didn't even know he was home yet. I'd just awake to my still dark room, Dad tickling my nose, whisper singing the Dean Martin song he'd named me for. "It's June in January because I'm in love." I'd jolt awake, heart trilling, knowing it meant a day on the boat, the two of us. Now I wondered if all those precious chilly mornings had been literal guilt trips, time for him to readjust to life with Mom after a weekend with that woman. I should save the storytelling for my manuscript. I pushed it all out of my mind and pulled a throw pillow over my face, sleep swallowing me like a biblical whale. When I jerked awake, the room was dark and there was music blasting through it. I stood and ambled, dazed and gin-fogged, toward the knife block in the kitchen. I hadn't heard of a serial killer who began each murder by rousing the victim with REM's Everybody Hurts, but I really couldn't rule out the possibility. As I moved toward the kitchen, the music dimmed, and I realized it was coming from the other side of the house, from the Grumps' house. I looked toward the glowing numbers on the stove. 12:30 at night, and my neighbor was blasting a song most often heard in dated dramedies wherein the protagonist walks home alone, hunched against the rain. I stormed toward the window and thrust my upper body through it. The Grumps' windows were open too, and I could see a swath of bodies lit up in the kitchen, holding glasses and mugs and bottles, leaning lazy heads on shoulders, looping arms around necks as the whole group sang along with fervor. It was a raging party. So apparently the Grump didn't hate all people, just me. I cupped my mouth around my hands and yelled out the window, "Excuse me!" I tried twice more with no response, then slammed the window closed and circled the first floor, snapping the others shut. When I was finished, it still sounded pretty much like REM was playing a concert on my coffee table. And then, for a beautiful moment, the song stopped, and the sounds of the party, laughter and chatter and bottles clinking, dipped to a static murmur. And then it started again. The same song, even louder. Oh, God. As I pulled my sweatpants back on, I contemplated the advantages of calling the police with a noise complaint. On the one hand, I might maintain plausible deniability with my neighbor. "Oh, 'twas not I who called the constable. I am but a young woman of 29, not a crotchety old spinster who loathes laughter, fun, song, and dance." On the other, ever since I'd lost my dad, I'd had a harder and harder time forgiving small offenses. I threw on my pizza print sweatshirt and stormed out the front door, marching up the neighbor's steps. Before I could second-guess myself, I'd reached for the doorbell. It rang out in the same powerful baritone as a grandfather clock, cutting through the music, but the singing didn't stop. I counted to 10, then rang it again. Inside, the voices didn't even waver. If the partygoers heard the doorbell, they were ignoring it. I pounded on the door for a few more seconds before accepting no one was coming, then turned to stomp home. 1 o'clock, I decided. I'd give them until 1 before I called the cops. The music was even louder in the house than I remembered, and in the few minutes since I'd shut the windows, the temperature had risen to a sticky swelter. With nothing better to do, I grabbed a paperback from my bag and headed for the deck, fumbling for the light switches beside the sliding door. My fingers hit them, but nothing happened. The bulbs outside were dead. Reading by phone light at 1 in the morning on the deck of my father's second home, it was. I stepped out, skin tingling from the refreshing chill of the breeze coming off the water. The Grump's deck was dark too, except for a lone fluorescent bulb surrounded by clumsy moths, which was why I nearly screamed when something moved in the shadows. And by nearly screamed, I of course mean definitely screamed.
Jesus!
The shadowy thing gasped and shot up from the chair where it had been sitting. And by shadowy thing, I of course mean man who'd been chilling in the dark until I scared the shit out of him.
What?
He demanded, like he expected me to announce that he was covered in scorpions. If he had been, this would be less awkward.
Nothing, I said, still breathing hard from the surprise. I didn't see you there.
You didn't see me here, he repeated.
He gave a scratchy, disbelieving laugh.
Really? You didn't see me on my own deck?
Technically, I didn't see him now either. The porch light was a few feet behind and above him, transforming him into nothing but a tallish, person-shaped silhouette with a halo ringing his dark, messy hair. At this point, it would probably be better if I managed to go the whole summer without having to make eye contact with him anyway.
Do you also scream when cars drive past on the highway, or you spot people through restaurant windows? Would you mind blacking out all our perfectly aligned windows so you don't accidentally see me when I'm holding a knife or a razor?
I crossed my arms viciously over my chest. Or tried to. The gin was still making me a little fuzzy and clumsy. What I meant to say, what the old January would have said, was, could you possibly turn your music down a little bit? Actually, she probably would have just slathered herself in glitter, put on her favorite velvet loafers, and shown up at the front door with a bottle of champagne, determined to win the Grump over. But so far, this was the 3rd worst day of my life, and that January was probably buried wherever they put the old Taylor Swift, so what I actually said was, "Could you turn off your sad boy angsting soundtrack?" The silhouette laughed and leaned against his deck railing, his beer bottle dangling from one hand.
Does it look like I'm the one running the playlist?
No, it looks like you're the one sitting in the dark alone at his own party, I said. But when I rang the doorbell to ask your frat brothers to turn down the volume, they couldn't hear me over the jello wrestling, so I'm asking you.
He studied me through the dark for a minute. Or at least, I assumed that was what he was doing, since neither of us could actually see the other. Finally, he said,
"Look, no one will be more thrilled than me when this night ends and everyone gets out of my house, but it is a Saturday night, in summer, on a street full of vacation homes. Unless this neighborhood got airlifted to the little town from Footloose, it doesn't seem crazy to play music this late. And maybe, just maybe, the brand new neighbor who stood on her deck screaming foot jobs so loud birds scattered could afford to be lenient if one miserable party goes later than she'd like."
Now it was my turn to stare at the dark blob. God, he was right. He was a Grump, but so was I. Karen and Sharon's vitamin powder pyramid scheme parties went later than this. And those were on weeknights, usually when Jacques had a shift at the ER the next morning. Sometimes I'd even attended those parties, and now I couldn't even handle Saturday night group karaoke. And worst of all, before I could figure out what to say, the Grump's house went miraculously silent. Through his illuminated back doors, I could see the crowd breaking up, hugging, saying goodbyes, setting down cups, and putting on jackets. I'd argued with this guy for nothing, and now I'd have to live next to him for months. If I needed sugar, I was going to be shit out of luck. I wanted to apologize for the sad boy angst comment, or at least for these goddamn pants. These days, my reactions always felt outsized, and there was no easy way to explain them when strangers had the bad fortune of witnessing them. "Sorry," I imagined myself saying. "I didn't mean to transform into a crotchety grandmother. It's just my dad died, and then I found out he had a mistress and a second house, and that my mom knew but never told me, and she still won't talk to me about any of it. And when I finally came apart, my boyfriend decided he didn't love me anymore, and my career has stalled, and my best friend lives too far away, and P.S., this is the aforementioned sex house, and I used to like parties, but lately I don't like anything, so please forgive my behavior and have a lovely evening. Thank you and good night." Instead, that knife-twisting pain hit my gut, and tears stung the back of my nose, and my voice squeaked pathetically as I said to no one in particular, "I'm so tired." Even silhouetted as he was, I could tell he went rigid. I'd learned it wasn't uncommon for people to do that when they intuited a woman was on the verge of emotional collapse. In the last few weeks of our relationship, Jacques was like one of those snakes that can sense an earthquake, going taut whenever my emotions rose, then deciding we needed something from the bodega and rushing out the door. My neighbor didn't say anything, but he didn't rush away either. He just stood there awkwardly, staring at me through the pitch dark. We faced off for easily 5 seconds, waiting to see what would happen first, me bursting into tears or him running away. And then the music started blaring again, a Carly Rae Jepsen banger that, under different circumstances, I loved, and the grump startled. He glanced back through the sliding doors, then to me again. He cleared his throat. "I'll kick them out," he said stiffly, then turned and went inside, a unanimous cheer of "Everett!" rising from the crowd in the kitchen at the sight of him. They sounded ready to hoist him up into a keg stand, but I could see him leaning over to shout to a blonde girl, and a moment later, the music fell silent for good. Well, next time I needed to make an impression, I might be better off with a plate of LSD cookies. Chapter 3. The Pete Cute. I awoke, head throbbing, to a text from Anya.
"Hey, baby cakes. Wanted to make sure you got my email regarding your glorious mind and the summer deadline we chatted about."
That period reverberated through my skull like a death knell. I'd gotten my first true hangover when I was 24, the morning after Anya sold my first book, Kiss Kiss Wish Wish, to Sandy Lowe. Jacques had bought his favorite French champagne to celebrate, and we drank it from the bottle as we walked the Brooklyn Bridge, waiting for the sun to rise, because we thought it seemed hugely romantic. Later, lying on the bathroom floor, I had sworn I'd fall on a sharp knife before I let my brain feel like an egg frying on a rock in the Cancun sun again. And yet, here I was, face pressed into a beaded throw pillow, brain sizzling in the saucepan of my skull. I ran to the downstairs bathroom. I didn't need to throw up, but I was hoping that if I pretended I did, my body would fall for it and evacuate the poison in my gut. I threw myself onto my knees in front of the toilet and lifted my eyes to the framed picture that hung from a ribbon on the wall behind it. Dad and that woman were on a beach, dressed in windbreakers, his arms wrapped around her shoulders, the wind pulling at her pre-white blonde hair and pushing his only just graying curls flat against his forehead as they grinned. And then, in a more understated but equally hilarious joke from the universe, I spotted the magazine rack beside the toilet, which contained exactly 3 offerings: a 2-year-old Oprah magazine, a copy of my 3rd book, Northern Light, and that damn The Revelatories, a hardcover with one of those shiny autographed stickers, no less. I opened my mouth and retched heartily into the toilet bowl. Then I stood, rinsed out my mouth, and turned the picture frame around so it faced the wall. "Never again," I said aloud. Step one to a hangover-free life? Probably not moving into a house that drives you to drink. I would have to find other coping mechanisms, like nature. I went back to the living room, fished my toothbrush from my bag, and brushed at the kitchen sink. The next essential step for me to go on existing was a coffee IV. Whenever I drafted a book, I pretty much lived in my illustrious give-up pants. So aside from a collection of equally terrible sweatpants, I'd packed pretty lightly for this trip. I'd even watched a handful of lifestyle vloggers' videos about capsule wardrobes in an attempt to maximize the amount of looks I could build from a pair of Daisy Dukes I mostly wore when I was stress cleaning and a collection of ratty t-shirts with celebrities' faces on them, remnants from a phase in my early 20s. I pulled on a somber black-and-white Joni Mitchell, stuffed my booze-bloated body into the denim cutoffs, and put on my floral-embroidered ankle boots. I had a thing about shoes, from the very cheap and tacky to the very expensive and dramatic. As it turned out, this thing of mine was fairly incompatible with the whole capsule wardrobe concept. I'd only packed 4 pairs, and I doubted anyone would consider my sparkly Target tennis shoes or the over-the-knee Stuart Weitzman boots I'd splurged on to be classic. I grabbed my car keys and was heading out into the blinding summer sun when I heard my phone buzzing from within the couch cushions. A message from Shoddy. "Made out with the haunted hat," followed by a bunch of skulls. As I stumbled outside again, I typed back, "See a priest immediately." I tried not to think about last night's humiliating face-off with the neighbor as I jogged down the steps to the Kia, but that just freed up my mind to wander to my least favorite subject, Dad. The last time we'd gone boating together, he'd driven us to the man-made lake in the Kia and told me he was giving it to me. It was also the day he told me I should go for it, move to New York. Jacques was already there for medical school, and we were doing the long-distance thing so I could be with Mom. Dad had to travel a lot for work, and even if I ultimately believed my own story, that our lives would always ultimately work out, a big part of me was still too scared to leave Mom alone, as if my absence would somehow make room for the cancer to creep back in a third time. "She's fine," Dad had promised as we sat in the frigid, dark parking lot. "It could come back," I'd argued. I didn't want to miss a second with her. "Anything could happen, January." That was what he'd said. "Anything could happen to Mom or me or even you at any point, but right now, nothing is. Do something for yourself for once, kiddo." Maybe he thought my moving to New York to live with my boyfriend was, at its core, the same as him buying a second house to hide away with his mistress. I'd given up grad school to help take care of Mom during that second round of chemo, put every cent I could toward helping with medical bills. And where had he been then? Wearing a windbreaker and drinking Pinot Noir on the beach with that woman? I pushed the thought away as I slid into the car, the leather hot against my thighs, and pulled away from the curb, cranking down the window as I went. At the end of the street, I turned left, away from the water, and headed into town. The inlet that reached down along the right side of the road threw slivers of sparkling light against my window, and the hot wind roared in my ears. For a minute, it was like my life had ceased to exist around me. I was just floating past hordes of scantily clad teenagers milling around the hot dog stand on my left, parents and kids lined up out the door of the ice cream shop on my right, packs of cyclists riding back toward the beach. As I cruised down the main drag, the buildings clumped closer until they were pressed shoulder to shoulder, a tiny Italian restaurant with vine-covered terraces flush with a skate shop, pressing it into the Irish pub next door, followed by an old-fashioned candy shop, and finally a cafe called Pete's Coffee,
spelled P-E-T-E-S, and not to be confused with the major chain Pete's, spelled P-E-E-T-S. Though the sign looked actually like it was specifically trying to be confused with the aforementioned brand. I pulled into a parking spot and ducked into the sweet chill of Pete's Not Pete's air conditioning. The floorboards were painted white and the walls were a deep blue, speckled with silver stars that swirled between tables, interrupted by the occasional framed platitude attributed to Anonymous. The room opened directly into a well-lit bookstore, the words Pete's Books painted in that same auspicious silver over the doorway. An elderly couple in fleece vests sat in the half-collapsed armchairs in the back corner. Aside from the late middle-aged woman at the register and me, they were the only people here.
"Much too nice of a day to be inside, I suppose," the barista said,
as if reading my thoughts. She had a gruff voice to match her blonde crew cut, and her tiny gold hoop earrings winked in the soft lighting as she waved me forward with a set of pale pink fingernails.
"Don't be shy. We're all family at Pete's."
I smiled. "God, I hope not." She slapped the counter as she laughed.
"Oh, family's tricky," she agreed. "Anyway, what can I get you?"
"Jet fuel." She nodded sagely.
"Ah, you're one of those. Where are you from, honey?"
"New York, most recently. Ohio before that."
"Oh, I've got family in New York. The state, not the city. You're talking about the city, though, aren't you?"
"Queens," I confirmed.
"Never been," she said. "You want any milk? Any syrup?"
"I'd do some milk," I said.
"Whole? Half? 1/16th?
"Surprise me. I'm not picky when it comes to fractions." She threw her head back and laughed again as she moved lackadaisically between machines.
"Who has time to be? I swear, even North Bear Shores moves too fast for me most days. Maybe if I took up drinking this jet fuel of yours, it'd be a different story."
Having a barista who did not drink espresso wasn't ideal, but I liked the woman with the tiny gold earrings. Honestly, I liked her so much that it sent a little pang of longing through me. For the old January, the one who loved throwing themed parties and coordinating group costumes, who couldn't go to the gas station or stand in line at the post office without winding up making plans to grab coffee or hit up a gallery opening with someone I just met. My phone was riddled with contacts like Sarah, the anchor bar, cute dog, and Mike runs that new vintage store. I'd even met Shoddy in a pizza shop bathroom when she came out of the stall wearing the best fry boots I'd ever seen. I missed feeling that deep curiosity about people, that spark of excitement when you realized you had something in common, or admiration when you uncovered a hidden talent or quality. Sometimes, I just missed liking people. But this barista, she was thoroughly likable. Even if the coffee sucked, I knew I'd be back. She tucked the plastic lid on the cup and plopped it down in front of me.
"No charge for first-timers," she said. "I just ask that you return."
I smiled, promised I would, and stuffed my last dollar bill into the tip jar as she went back to mopping up the counters. On my way back to the door, I froze, Anya's voice running through my head.
"Hey, sugar cube. Seriously, not trying to overstep, but you know, book clubs are your dream market. If you're literally in a small town bookstore, you should pop over and say hey."
I knew imaginary Anya was right. Right now, every sale mattered to me. Plastering a smile on my face, I passed through the doorway into the bookstore. If only I could travel back in time and choose to put on any outfit besides the 2002 Jessica Simpson music video extra costume I was sporting. The store was small oak shelves along the outside walls and a hodgepodge labyrinth of shorter bookshelves tunneling back and forth between them. The register was unattended, and as I waited, I glanced toward the trio of braces-wearing preteens in the romance section to make sure it wasn't one of my books they were giggling over. All four of us would be irrevocably traumatized if the bookseller led me over to sign stock only to discover a copy of Southern Comfort in the redhead's hands.
The girls gasped and tittered as the redhead clutched the book to her chest, revealing the cover, a topless man and woman embracing as flames leapt around them. Definitely not one of mine. I took a sip of the latte and promptly spit it back into the cup. It tasted like mud.
Sorry about the wait, hon.
The scratchy voice came from over my shoulder, and I spun to face the woman zigzagging toward me through the crooked rows of shelves.
These knees don't move like they used to.
At first, I thought she must be the barista's identical twin, sisters who'd opened the business together. But then I realized the woman was untying her gray Pete's apron from her waist as she made her way to the register.
Do you believe I used to be a roller derby champion?
She said as she dropped the wadded apron on the counter.
Well, believe it or not, I did.
At this point, I'd hardly be surprised to find out you're the mayor of North Bear Shores. She gave a rattling laugh.
Oh no, can't say that I am. Though maybe I could get some shit done around here, if they'd have me. This town is a nice little pocket of progressivism here in the Mitten, but the people with the purse strings are still a bunch of pearl-clutching golf bags.
I fought a smile. It sounded so much like something Dad would have said. The ache seared through me, fire poker sharp and hot.
Anyway, don't mind me and my opinions, she enunciated, lifting her thick ash-blonde brows. I'm just a lowly entrepreneur. What can I do for you, sugar?
I just wanted to introduce myself, I admitted. I'm a writer, actually, with Sandy Low Books, and I'm here for the summer, so I figured I'd say hi, sign stock if you have any.
Oh, another writer in town, she cried. How exciting! You know, North Bear brings in a lot of artist types. It's our way of life, I think. And the college. All sorts of free thinkers over there. A beautiful little community. You're going to love it here.
The way her words dropped off suggested she was waiting for me to insert my own name at the end of her sentence. January, I chimed in. Andrews.
Pete,
she said, shaking my hand with the vigor of a green beret who's just said,
"Put her there, son."
Pete, I said. Of Pete's coffee fame?
The very same. Legal name's Posey. What kind of a name is that?
She pantomimed, gagging.
Seriously, do I look like a posy to you? Does anyone look like a posy?
I shook my head. Maybe like a baby wearing a polyester flower costume?
Soon as I could talk, I set that one straight. Anyway, January Andrews.
Pete stepped up to the computer and plugged my name into the keyboard.
Let's see if we've got your book.
I never corrected people when they said singular book rather than plural books, but sometimes the assumption dug under my skin. It made me feel like people thought my career was a fluke, like I'd sneezed and a romance novel came out. And then there were the people who acted like we were in on some secret joke together when, after a conversation about art or politics, they found out I wrote upbeat women's fiction.
Whatever pays the bills, right?
They'd say. Practically begging me to confirm I didn't want to write books about women or love.
Looks like we don't have any in stock,
Pete said, looking up from the screen.
But I tell you what, you'd better believe I'm ordering them in.
That'd be great, I said. Maybe we could host a workshop later this summer. Pete gasped and clutched my arm.
Idea, January Andrews! You should come to our book club. We'd love to have you. Great way to get involved in the community. It's Mondays. Can you do Monday? Tomorrow?
In my head, Anya said,
You know what made the girl on the train happen? Book clubs.
That was a stretch, but I liked Pete.
Mondays work?
Fantastic. I'll send you my address. 7 p.m., lots of booze, always a hoot.
She pulled a business card from the desk and passed it across the counter.
You do email, don't you?
Almost constantly. Pete's smile widened.
Well, you just shoot me a message and we'll make sure you're all set for tomorrow.
I promised her I would and turned to go, nearly colliding with the display table. I watched the pyramid of books tremble, and as I stood there, waiting to see if they'd fall, I realized the entire thing was made out of the same book, each marked with an autographed sticker. An uncanny tingle climbed my spine. There, on the abstract black and white cover, in square red letters beneath The Revelatories, was his name. It was all coming together in my mind, a domino trail of realizations. I didn't mean to say it aloud, but I might have, because the bells over the bookshop door tinkled, and when I looked up, there he was. Olive skin, cheekbones that could cut you, crooked mouth, and a husky voice I'd never forget. Messy, dark hair I could immediately picture haloed in fluorescent light. Augustus Everett. Gus, as I'd known him back in college.
Everett,
as Pete was calling affectionately from behind the desk. My neighbor, the grump. I did what any reasonable adult woman would do when confronted with her college rival turned next door neighbor. I dove behind the nearest bookshelf. Chapter 4. The Mouth. The worst part of being college rivals with Gus Everett, probably the fact that I wasn't sure he knew we were. He was 3 years older, a high school dropout who'd gotten his GED after spending a few years working as a literal gravedigger. I knew all of this because every story he turned in our first semester was part of a collection centering on the cemetery where he'd worked. The rest of us in the creative writing program were pulling fodder from our asses and childhoods. Soccer games won in the last instant, fights with parents, road trips with friends. And Gus Everett was writing about the 8 kinds of mourning widows, analyzing the most common epitaphs, the funniest, the ones that subtly betrayed a strained relationship between the deceased and the person footing the headstone's bill. Like me, Gus was at U of M on a slew of scholarships, but it was unclear how he'd gotten them, since he played no sports and hadn't technically graduated from high school. The only explanation was that he was atrociously good at what he did. To top things off, Gus Everett was stupidly, infuriatingly attractive. And not the universal kind of handsome that almost dulls itself with objectivity. It was more of a magnetism he emanated. Sure, he was just barely on the tall side of average, with the lean muscle of someone who never stopped moving around, but also never intentionally exercised. A lazy kind of fit that came from genetics and restlessness rather than good habits. But it was more than that. It was the way he talked and moved, how he looked at things. Not like how he saw the world, literally how he looked at things, his eyes seeming to darken and grow whenever he focused, his eyebrows furrowing over his dented nose. Not to mention his crooked mouth, which should have been outlawed. Before she dropped out of U of M to become an au pair, a pursuit soon abandoned, Shoddy would ask me nightly at dinner for updates on sexy, evil Gus, sometimes abbreviated as SEG. I was minorly besotted with him and his prose. Until we finally spoke for the first time in class. I was passing out my latest short story for critique, and when I handed it to him, he looked me dead in the eyes, his head tilted curiously, and said,
"Let me guess, everyone lives happily ever after. Again."
I wasn't writing romance yet. I didn't even realize how much I loved reading romance until Mom's second diagnosis 2 years later, when I needed a good distraction. But I was definitely writing romantically about a good world where things happened for a reason, where love and human connection were all that really mattered. And Gus Everett had looked at me with those eyes, deepening and darkening like they were sucking every bit of information about me into his skull, and he'd determined that I was a balloon in need of popping. "Let me guess, everyone lives happily ever after. Again." We spent the next 4 years taking turns winning our school's writing prizes and contests, but managed to barely speak again, unless you counted workshops,
during which he rarely critiqued anyone's stories except mine and nearly always showed up late without half his stuff and asked to borrow my pens. And there was one wild night at a frat party where we'd not quite talked, but definitely interacted. Frankly, we crossed paths constantly, partly because he dated two separate roommates of mine and plenty of other girls on my floor, though I use the term dated loosely. Gus was notorious for having a 2 to 4 week dating shelf life, and while the first roommate had started things up with him hoping to be the exception, the second, and plenty of the others, went in fully aware Gus Everett was just someone you could have fun with for up to 31 days. Unless you wrote short stories with happy endings, in which case you were apparently far more likely to spend 4 years as rivals, pass another 6 occasionally Googling him to compare your careers, and then run into him here while dressed like a teen cheerleader at a car wash fundraiser. As in, here, now, walking into Pete's books. I was already planning what I would text Shoddy as I power walked down the side of the store, chin tucked and face angled into the shelves like I was casually browsing, whilst practically jogging, as one does.
"January?" Pete was calling. "January, where'd you go? I want you to meet someone."
I'm not proud to admit that when I froze, I was looking at the door, judging whether I could make it out of there without responding. It's important to note that I knew for a fact there were bells over the door, and I still couldn't make an immediate decision. Finally, I took a deep breath, forced a smile, and stepped out from between the shelves, clutching my god-awful latte like it was a handgun. "Hi," I said, then waved in a distinctly animatronic way. I had to force myself to look directly at him. He looked just like he did in his author photo. All sharp cheekbones, furiously dark eyes, and the leanly muscled arms of a grave digger turned novelist. He was wearing a rumpled blue or faded black t-shirt and rumpled dark blue or faded black jeans, and his hair had started streaking through with gray, along with the just past 5 o'clock shadow around his crooked mouth.
"This is January Andrews," Pete announced. "She's a writer. Just moved here."
I could practically see the same realization dawning on his face that had just crashed down on mine, his eyes homing in as he pieced together whatever bits of me he'd caught in the dark last night.
"We've met, actually," he said.
The fire of 1,000 suns rushed to my face, and probably my neck and chest and legs and every other exposed inch of my body.
"Oh?"
Pete said, delighted.
"How's that?"
My mouth fell open silently, the word college somehow evading grasp as my eyes shifted back to Gus's.
"We're neighbors," he said.
"I believe." Oh, God. Was it possible he didn't remember me at all? My name was January, for shit's sake. It wasn't like I was a Rebecca or a Christy, Christina, Christine. I tried not to think too hard about how Gus could have forgotten me, because doing so would only take my complexion from overcooked lobster to eggplant.